Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today, we're embarking on a really fascinating exploration. We're looking at a place that's, well, it's the cosmological and spiritual heart of the Yazidi faith, the Leish. For so many, Leilish isn't just, you know, a spot on a map. It's revered as Leilisha and Nirani. Leilish is the luminous.
That's right.
Believed to be the very center of the world, where creation itself began, actually, and the first place on Earth touched by the sun's divine light.
A powerful origin story.
It really is. And it's home to the tomb of Sheikh Adi ibn Musafir, who is, as you know, the most revered saint in Yazidism. It's the destination for that obligatory lifetime pilgrimage.
Absolutely essential.
But what's truly striking about Leish, I think, is this profound paradox right at its core. It's a place of immense spiritual tranquility, yet throughout its history, it's been the target of these repeated violent campaigns, just aimed at its cultural, even physical annihilation.
Indeed. And that's really what we want to trace in this exploration, Leilish's comprehensive history, but seen as a narrative of, well, profound survival.
Exactly.
We'll delve into its ancient origins, try to decode some of its unique architectural symbology, immerse ourselves, you can say, in its vibrant living rituals, and also understand its modern role. Its role as this unwavering sanctuary of resilience, especially, you know, in the face of immense challenges like the 2014 genocide by ISIS.
A story etched into its very stones, as you said.
Precisely.
Yeah.
We'll find that its story is etched into its very stones. Mm-hmm. Every part of it tells that story.
So let's start there. Let's unpack this idea of Leilish as the very nexus of creation. How do the sources elaborate on its cosmic significance? What does this belief really mean for the physical place, Leilish itself?
Well, what's truly fascinating here is just how profoundly ingrained this belief is.
Yeah.
It's not just a nice story. It's fundamental to the Yazidi understanding of existence.
Right.
Their ancient oral tradition, it describes a literal event, a foundational event for their cosmology. They speak of the earth itself only settling, finding stability.
Only settling
when Leilish and the Yazesh, and they explicitly call it the throne of God, when it came down upon the earth during creation.
Wow, came down upon it.
Exactly. So imagine that, not just a holy site, but the ultimate anchor, the very point of stability in this nascent cosmos, literally grounding the world.
That imbues the physical place with incredible significance.
Unparalleled sacredness. It makes the valley the geographical and spiritual locus of their universe, a place where the divine, you know, literally touched down and solidified creation. Every inch of Leilish carries that echo.
And there are scholarly interpretations, too. You mentioned Dr. Rusho.
Yes, Dr. Khalil Jindi Rusho provides deeper insight. He interprets the relationship between the earthly Leilish we see and a kind of heavenly metaphysical Leilish.
Okay.
He sees it as akin to the intimate connection between God and the human soul. Very close.
How does he visualize that connection?
He vividly describes this mysterious tree of knowledge, known as Gyu. It functions as a sort of cosmic conduit, intricately connecting these two realms, the heavenly and the earthly.
A tree of knowledge, connecting heaven and earth at Leilish.
That's the idea. Its roots, he explains, absorb divine gnosis, which in this context means profound, intuitive, spiritual knowledge about the divine order, about creation, absorbs it in the heavenly realm. And then, through its branches, this divine wisdom is continuously distributed. It flows down to earth, precisely at the physical site of Leilish.
So Leilish isn't just historic, it's a live feed, almost.
That's a great way to put it. A continuous living channel for divine wisdom and revelation. A place where the sacred perpetually permeates the physical world. It's a constant source of spiritual nourishment, of guidance. This shapes a worldview where divine truth is always accessible through Leilish.
That's a truly powerful image, a constant flow. And as we touched on, Leilish's spiritual importance is just intrinsically linked to Sheikh Adi ibn Musafir. Who was he exactly, and how did his arrival really cement Leilish's role?
Sheikh Adi, yes, a pivotal figure, a 12th century Sufi mystic. He originally came from the Biaka Valley in Lebanon.
Right.
He journeyed east to the Kurdish mountains, not far from modern-day Mosul, and it was there in the Valley of Leilish that he founded a Sufi order, the Al-Adawiya Order.
And this founding was key.
Absolutely transformative. This move, establishing his order in Leilish, it marked the definitive beginnings of the Yazidis as an organized religious community with a conscious, defined sense of identity.
So before him, things were perhaps more disparate.
That's likely. His presence in Leilish provided this cohesive spiritual and social structure. It gathered and formalized traditions. His teachings, the order he founded, they were a powerful catalyst, unifying tribes, clans, under a shared spiritual banner, all centered geographically and devotionally right there in Lalish.
And you can still see that Sufi influence today.
Oh, definitely. To this very day, Yazidism retains a social structure that's clearly modeled on a Sufi brotherhood. It reflects Sheikh Adi's enduring legacy. Mm. Their mythology is rich with references to great Sufi figures. It underscores its deep historical link that just radiates from Lalish, even their religious language. It's infused with Sufi images, symbols, terminology. Now, it's important to remember, these elements have undergone, you know, profound metamorphoses over centuries. They've acquired unique new significances within the distinct Yazidi faith.
Of course, adapted.
Exactly. But their Sufi roots are undeniable, and they continue to shape much of the faith's expression, its communal organization, and it all radiates from that spiritual center established in Lalish.
So if I understand correctly, Sheikh Adi's presence wasn't just like a historical footnote. It was the moment that solidified Lalish as the absolute paramount spiritual center. What does that mean for the physical space today? Why is it so essential?
Precisely. It means Lalish became, and it remains, the undisputed spiritual and historical nucleus of the entire Yazidi world.
The nucleus.
At its very heart lies the sacred tomb of Sheikh Adi himself, and alongside him, his significant successor, Sheikh Hessen.
Right, Sheikh Hessen, too.
This physical presence transforms Lalish. It's not just a holy place. It's the singular, obligatory destination for that lifetime pilgrimage for all Yazidis. The Hajj.
The Hajj. Every Yazidi, if possible.
Yes, it's their spiritual lodestar, the point to which every believer must journey at least once. And this pilgrimage, it isn't merely a religious duty, it's a profound act of identity affirmation, a reconnection to the very origins of their faith, their community.
So the tomb itself is like a beacon.
An enduring beacon, drawing the faithful from across the globe, making Lalish the geographical and spiritual anchor of their collective identity, their religious practice. Its stones literally embody their history and their future.
Let's talk about those stones, that architecture. Lalish is described as having this unique architectural symbology. The structure itself communicates the faith. Can you guide us through some of that? Show us how the space is almost like a spiritual text.
Absolutely. It really is. When you enter the main temple, the Lalish temple, you step into this grand nave, and it's supported by seven massive ancient stone pillars.
Seven pillars.
Seven. And they're far more than just structural supports. They're deeply imbued with symbolic meaning. Each pillar represents one of the seven holy angels. Mm. Collectively, they're known as the Heptad.
The Heptad. The ones God entrusted with the world.
Exactly. The powerful divine beings God entrusted with the care and stewardship of the world after its creation. The number seven itself is deeply resonant in their belief system, signifies completeness, divine order, and these pillars, they make that concrete.
And they're decorated.
Yes. Traditionally draped in brightly colored silks.
Yeah.
It adds to their visual significance, reinforces their sacred living nature within the temple.
And pilgrims interact with these pillars. There's a ritual.
There is. A simple yet profoundly meaningful one. Pilgrims approach a pillar and they untie a knot. A knot that's been carefully made by a previous visitor.
Untie someone else's knot.
Yes. And symbolically, this releases that former visitor's prayer or wish, sends it forth, you could say, into the divine realm.
Ah, okay.
And then immediately afterwards, they tie a new knot of their own. So they're embedding their personal hopes, their intentions, their prayers directly into the very fabric of this sacred space.
Wow. Connecting prayers across time.
Exactly. It's not just a physical act. It creates this tangible, multi-generational connection within the temple's living history. It links the prayers and aspirations of countless individuals. It's a remarkable way the architecture facilitates this continuous spiritual dialogue, makes the temple a dynamic, living repository of collective faith.
That's truly beautiful, connecting past, present, future. Beyond these structural symbols, the idea of perpetual light and also provision seems really significant. How is that manifested? How does it go beyond symbolism?
Yeah, it gets really interesting here. It reveals this profound commitment to both sacred symbolism and communal care that really defines Lalish.
Yep.
Every single evening, without fail, 365 oil lamps are meticulously lit throughout the valley.
365, one for each day.
Exactly. One for each day of the year. It's this powerful, constant symbol of the eternal, life-giving light of God, ensuring the Holy Valley is never left in darkness.
It must be incredible to see.
It is. But it reinforces the belief that Lalish is perpetually blessed by divine illumination. And importantly, it's not just symbolism. The oil from these very lamps
Yes.
is considered to have medicinal and healing properties. It's a tangible source of blessing, of spiritual well-being for the faithful. Used to anoint pilgrims, sometimes used in healing practices.
So light and healing. And what about provision? Sustenance.
Furthermore, sacred bread, it's called perub, is baked continuously, daily. And it's stored in a treasury right within the complex.
Baked every day.
Every day. And this bread is freely available to any pilgrim who might be in need. It symbolizes not only spiritual sustenance, but also the community's unwavering commitment to caring for its members, especially those undertaking the pilgrimage who might be vulnerable.
A continuous act of generosity.
And divine provision, deeply integrated into the daily life of the sanctuary. These practices, the perpetual light, the unending bread, they're active, living components. They highlight Lailish's role as a source of comfort, healing, communal unity. It just reinforces its sanctity.
It really sounds like a living spiritual ecosystem, every element infused with meaning. And water, you mentioned, plays a crucial role, like in many ancient traditions. What are its specific sources in Lailish, and what's their significance in the rituals?
Yes, water is vital. The valley is blessed with two incredibly important natural springs. There's Kanyaspai, that translates to the White Spring, and the Zimzim Spring.
Kanyaspai and Zimzim.
Right. Both are vital sources of sacred water, absolutely essential for the purification rituals performed there.
Purification rituals, like baptism.
Similar. During major festivals, like the Autumn Festival, which draws thousands, pilgrims engage in Morkirin. It's a profound form of spiritual washing or baptism, performed specifically at the Kanyaspai, the White Spring.
To cleanse themselves spiritually.
Exactly. Prepare them for deeper engagement with the sacred space. And they also perform Selikirin, which is a kind of holy greeting, at the Zimzim Spring. They wash their faces and hands with its sacred water. A gesture of reverence, of renewal.
Marking a transition.
Yes. Cleansing them physically and spiritually. Preparing them for the deeper experiences within the valley. And there's another key ritual involving passage.
The bridge.
Exactly. Crossing the Pira Salat, or Salat Bridge. This act is profoundly symbolic. It represents the pilgrim's passage from the profane, the everyday world, into the sacred, consecrated life of the Holy Valley. It's not just walking across a bridge. It's a literal and metaphorical step into a heightened state of spiritual awareness. A commitment to the sacred.
And after the bridge?
Once they've crossed, they then circumambulate Sheikh Adi's tomb three times, a gesture of profound reverence, devotion, before finally entering the main temple, completing the ritual entry into this most holy of spaces.
It's a layered journey.
Very much so. Each step, each ritualized interaction with the waters, the structures, it profoundly connects the pilgrim to the sanctity, the history of the site, just reinforces its unique place in their spiritual lives.
Oh, Hannah, the Chai Lady, is here. Roach Bosch, Hannah.
Oh, wonderful timing. Roach Bosch.
This is my favorite part of our explorations. Let's see what we have today.
The aroma is particularly strong today. It hints at some rich spices, a truly inviting scent. Very cardamom forward, maybe.
You know, I think this chai is just right today. Not too bitter at all. Perfectly balanced, actually, with just that hint of sweetness. How about yours?
Mine too. It's lovely. It's got a robustness that speaks of the deep tradition of chai itself, doesn't it? Perfect for a reflection. And gathering our thoughts before we continue.
Agreed. Perfect. Okay. Where were we? Ah, yes. The living tradition.
The keepers.
Right. The sources emphasize the Kuals and the oral tradition as absolutely central, indispensable, really, to Lailish and Yazidism. What makes them such vital keepers of this living tradition, especially given, you know, the historical lack of a formalized written canon? How does their role connect specifically to Lailish's spiritual heritage?
The Kuals. Yes, they are, quite literally, the living memory of the Yazidi religion, particularly as it relates to Lailish. They are the conduits, the way the faith endures, transmitted across generations.
The living memory.
Exactly. During religious ceremonies in Lailish, and these ceremonies would be, well, incomplete without them, they sing the sacred hymns. These are known as kyuls.
Kyuls.
Accompanied by their sacred instruments, the flute, shibab, and the tambourine, def. And these kyuls, they are the primary source of doctrinal references. Ritual references. They form the very theological foundation of Yazidism.
So the core teachings are in these hymns.
Yes. And crucially, they recount the creation myths, the history of the saints, and very importantly, the significance of Lailish itself. This ensures the continuous transmission of their religious heritage directly connected to their sacred center.
And this role is passed down.
Exclusively. This lore is transmitted strictly from father to son. It's a hereditary succession. No one born from a non-Kyuol lineage can become a Kyuol. It preserves this unique, tightly controlled chain of knowledge.
Fascinating. And they traveled?
Historically, yes. They resided mainly in the twin villages of Beshik Bazani near Mosul. From there, they would travel out to other Yazidi communities. These journeys were vital.
Why vital?
Well, they served not just to spread teachings, but to maintain the spiritual connection between these scattered communities and the Lash, their spiritual heart. There's a common, powerful saying that encapsulates this, Mi Man Ji Quel.
Which means?
Our faith comes from the sacred poems. It shows just how central these sung traditions are. While many believe Sheikh Adi himself wrote numerous keels, some are clearly much older. And new ones have been composed by later generations, too. It shows a dynamic, evolving tradition, but one that always circles back to those foundational stories centered on Lalish.
So this reliance on oral tradition, it naturally means there isn't one single universally accepted written book like in some other faiths.
Correct. No fixed canon, no rigidly unified theological system in the way you might see in, say, the Abrahamic religions. Mm-hmm. Consequently, you find many different versions of the same myths, the same hymns across various communities.
Different versions.
Yes. In fact, one fascinating source mentioned something called the Song of the Commoner. It's apparently sung at 4 a.m. in the guest house of Lalish. Yes, but very few people actually hear it. It highlights the sometimes esoteric nature of some of this knowledge. Mm. This particular song is considered a Yazidi version of the Call of Awakening, a literary genre known from late antiquity.
Wow, late antiquity. That shows the depth of these traditions.
It really does. Ancient roots, all preserved and performed right there in Lalish.
That's a remarkable system for preservation, but as you said, with inherent variability. So how has this long-standing oral tradition, with its fluidity, been impacted by the modern world, by the influence of other traditions that rely heavily on written scriptures? How does that tension play out in relation to Lalish?
It's a really fascinating and complex interplay, and it directly impacts how Yazidis engage with their traditions, the ones stemming from Lalish. There's definitely a growing desire within the community
and desire
for a fixed, canonized body of writings. And this is often influenced, yes, by the religions of the book, Judaism, Christianity, Islam.
Is it just influence or is there more to it?
Well, it's partly a direct response to historical accusations. Accusations that Yazidis lacked written scriptures. This was often used by outsiders to brand them as kafirs, unbelievers, which in turn was used to justify persecution.
Ah, so a defense mechanism, in a way.
Partly, yes. So now you see younger, educated Yazidis increasingly turning to published materials, things like periodicals, Lalish magazine, Raj newspaper, or even Western scholarship, like John Guest's Survival Among the Kurds, to learn about their traditions.
Using written sources to understand an oral tradition?
Exactly. And this sometimes leads to a process of, well, maybe re-editing religion in their minds. They're seeking to reconcile the traditional oral lore with modern understanding, maybe formalize their theological framework in ways that weren't traditionally necessary.
Does that create friction?
It creates both opportunities and, yes, sometimes tensions. On one hand, it allows for a potentially more unified, accessible understanding of their faith. It helps counter external misrepresentations, strengthen identity, and Lalish often serves as the thematic anchor for these published works. But on the other hand, it can lead to debates about authenticity, about potentially losing the nuance that's inherent in fluid oral traditions. The essence of Lalish, though, remains absolutely central to these discussions. It is the undisputed source, the repository of the traditions they're seeking to perhaps codify or understand through writing.
So Lalish is central even to how they adapt to modernity.
Very much so. It's a fascinating case study of how a community adapts its ancient heritage, deeply rooted in a physical sacred space like Lalish, to the demands of modernity, to external pressures, all while solidifying their unique identity through their connection to Lalish.
That's a profound shift, trying to codify what was once fluid. Beyond the oral traditions, Lalish is also associated with these powerful symbolic objects like the sanjak that actually travel. What's the significance of the sanjak and other key objects in maintaining that spiritual link to Lalish, especially for Yazidis who live far away?
Yes, the sanjak. It's an incredibly potent symbol. It's a bronze image of a peacock. Yes, revered as the representation of Tawusimelek, the peacock angel, who is considered the chief angel, the protecting angel of the Yazidis. It's their most sacred object, usually kept well hidden from outsiders due to its profound sanctity.
And there was more than one.
Originally, tradition says there were seven such peacocks. Each corresponded to one of the seven traditional Yazidi districts. Interestingly, these districts themselves were also called sanjaks.
Sanjak the district, yeah. Sanjak the object.
Right. Likely a term adopted from Ottoman administration. But these districts stretched over vast territories, from Aleppo way over to Iran, and from Iraq up into the Caucasus, shows the historical spread of the community, all connected, at least nominally, back to Lalish.
And where were these sanjaks kept?
Traditionally, either in Lalish itself, the Sacred Valley, or sometimes at the Yazidi prince's house in Bandra. But the tradition of Toscan-Iran is key here for maintaining the connection.
Toscan-Iran.
Yes. This is when Kielals traveled to distant Yazidi communities, carrying a sanjak with them on tour.
Taking the sacred object to the people.
Exactly. And this extensive tour serves a triple purpose. First, to transmit religious teachings, Kiwals, singing the Kiwals. Second, to collect alms, donations, often for the upkeep of Lalish and its religious figures.
Okay.
And third, crucially, to reinforce the spiritual link between all Yazidis, no matter how far-flung they are, and their sacred center at Lalish. For communities, especially in the diaspora today, the arrival of a sanjak is incredibly powerful. It's a tangible reminder of their unity, their enduring connection to their spiritual home. It's a way to counteract fragmentation, maintain identity, anchored in Lalish.
It's a traveling piece of Lalish, in a sense. And what about the kirk, the garment of faith, and the headdress, the coif? What do these signify? How do they connect people to Lalish?
The black kirk is a kind of sacred shirt or garment. And the coif, the conical hat, which is also sometimes called a luminous black crown, These are extremely important symbols, intrinsically tied to the spiritual authority that emanates from Lalish.
Sheikh Adi's own garments.
Yes. Sheikh Adi's own kirk and coif are carefully guarded in Lalish. And tradition holds that light once actually shone from them, signifying their profound spiritual power, their divine connection.
Light shone from them.
That's the tradition. And today, the leader of the Fikors, these are individuals who have attained a high degree of spiritual enlightenment, purity, through their devotion.
The Fikors, right.
The leader wears these original garments during the sacred evening dance, the Sima, performed right there in the central sanctuary of Lalish. This act continues a direct line of spiritual authority and tradition. It physically manifests the spiritual legacy of Sheikh Adi within the sacred space he established.
So it connects directly back to him. What's the deeper symbolism?
Well, these garments are profound symbols of divine gnosis, of spiritual enlightenment. In Yazidi myth, the kirk is linked to Adam's angelic apparel back in paradise, signifying that pristine divine state of humanity before the fall.
Like Adam's original clothing.
Something like that. The divine essence, or sur, of the angel Sheikh Sin was said to dwell in Adam's forehead, and the kirk was put on him. It implies this deep connection to divine light, an elevated pure status originating from the earliest moments of creation.
And it relates to the future, too.
Yes. The kirk and crown are also promised as an eschatological reward for the faithful, symbolizing their salvation, their spiritual transformation in the end times. They represent this continuous line of divine connection, a preordained spiritual destiny, making these objects living symbols of the Yazidi spiritual journey, deeply rooted in the sacred history and enduring power of Lalish as a center of spiritual illumination, a gateway to divine grace.
It's truly heartbreaking, then, to consider that this beautiful, peaceful spiritual center, so rich in meaning, has faced such incredible violence, attempts at annihilation throughout its history. Can you walk us through some of the most notable attacks, the desecrations that Lalish has endured?
It is a tragic irony, isn't it, that such a serene, profoundly sacred place has been so repeatedly targeted. It's a testament, really, to the persistent persecution the Yazidi people themselves have faced. And we see this pattern, this brutal pattern of violent campaigns stretching back centuries.
Centuries.
Yes. For instance, back in 1254, Lalish was brutally sacked by Badr al-Din al-Lulu. He was the Atabeg of Mosul at the time. And this wasn't just, you know, a military conquest. It was a deliberate act of religious desecration.
What to do?
During this devastating attack, Sheikh Adi's bones, the very remains of their most revered saint, were exhumed, dug up, and publicly burned.
Burned. Oh, that's horrific.
An unimaginable horror for the Yazidis. A direct assault on the spiritual heart of their community, their sacred lineage. And to compound it, Sheikh Adi's successor, Sheikh Hasan ibn Adi, was also executed. That event left a deep, painful scar on the collective memory connected to Lalish.
I can only imagine, and it didn't stop there.
No. The assaults continued with disturbing regularity. In 1415, the temple was attacked and burned again, this time by Izz al-Din al-Hulwani and the Sindhi tribe, left it in ruins. But, and this is critical, it was later rebuilt by the Yazidis, shows their immediate determination.
They rebuilt it.
They did. no matter the cost.
Yeah, it was.
Fast forward to 1892, during the Ottoman occupation. A different kind of violence emerged, cultural violence. General Omar Wabi Pasha.
What did he do?
In a calculated move of assimilation of erasure, he converted the Lalish Temple into a Quranic school and systematically looted sacred items, including some of the sanjaks.
Turned it into a school.
Yes. It wasn't just physical damage. It was a deliberate attempt at cultural and religious erasure, trying to stamp out the Yazidi identity by transforming its most sacred space into a symbol of another faith. These events, stretching across centuries, they just underscore this continuous struggle for survival that Lalish and, by extension, the Yazidi people have faced. It solidifies its identity as a site of both profound reverence and, unfortunately, enduring vulnerability.
But despite these devastating attacks, these attempts at erasure, Lalish was always reclaimed, wasn't it? How did the community respond? What does this recurring pattern of determined reconstruction reveal about their spirit, their connection to Lalish?
Absolutely. It was always reclaimed. And each attack, paradoxically, only seemed to deepen Lalish's significance for the Yazidi people. It reinforced its role as this unyielding focal point of their identity, their resilience, a symbol that just refused to be extinguished.
So the attacks almost strengthened its importance.
In a way, yes. For example, in 1904, there was this powerful act of defiance. Mir Ali Beg and Yazidi forces successfully recaptured Lalish. They drove out the Muslim occupiers who had taken it over following Wabi Pasha's actions and decisively restored Yazidi control.
They took it back by force.
They did. And this act of determined reconstruction, whether it's physical rebuilding after burning or forceful reclaiming, it's a recurring, powerful theme in Lalish's long history. It demonstrates their unwavering resolve to preserve their spiritual home. The very act of rebuilding Lalish became almost a ritual in itself, a testament to their unbroken faith.
And this resilience continued right into our times.
Profoundly so. Tragically culminating, of course, in the 2014 genocide perpetrated by ISIS. This represents perhaps the most brutal, horrific chapter in Yazidi history, aiming for complete annihilation.
Unimaginable.
Yet even this horrific event, rather than breaking the community, it solidified Lalish's ultimate role, not just as a place of worship, but as an unwavering sanctuary. A beacon of hope, of survival in the face of that adversity.
How did it function as a sanctuary during that time?
Well, during the ISIS onslaught, Lalish became a vital refuge. Not just physically for some, but spiritually. It protected ancient scrolls, religious texts that were brought there for safety. And it provided this immense psychological anchor for displaced, traumatized people. Its enduring presence was a source of strength when everything else seemed to be falling apart. It truly proved its sanctuary status.
And beyond surviving conflict, the community has been actively strengthening traditions around Lalish.
Yes, very actively. For instance, seminary schools, which are actually a historic first for the community, have been opened specifically to train teachers in Yazidi religious studies.
Training their own teachers.
Exactly. And what's even more remarkable, many of these teacher candidates are women.
Really? That's significant.
Hugely significant. It marks a progressive break from a traditionally male domain in religious instruction. It indicates this proactive redefinition of roles within the community, strengthening its core from within. Teachers for Yazidi religious classes in places like the Efrin Canton, for example, were trained for months in the curriculum that originated from these Lalish schools in Iraq. Shows a tangible link, a continuity of religious education radiating directly from the Sacred Valley.
And they're demonstrating this renewed identity publicly.
They are. We're seeing public demonstrations of this newly gained strong Yazidi identity, directly linked to Lalish. Things like graduation ceremonies for these new teachers, complete with candle lighting symbolizing that perpetual illumination of Lalish, and the recitation of kules, their sacred hymns, connecting the present generation directly to their ancient oral traditions. And organizations like the Yazidi House are calling for branches in every Yazidi village. They're emphasizing the strengthening of women's roles within the community, within the religion. All while looking towards Lalish as their guiding star, their source of renewed identity. These efforts aren't just about preservation. They're about vitalizing their faith, their communal structure, rooted firmly in Lalish.
It really sounds like a community that's not just resisting, but actively redefining and reinforcing its identity from within. Drawing strength, new meaning, from its ancient roots in Lalish. And this even extends to reevaluating their own historical narratives, creating new origin myths.
Precisely. In some instances, this reassertion of identity involves creating, or perhaps highlighting, certain narratives, new origin myths, if you like to confer prestige and establish a more recognized place within broader historical narratives. And this process invariably centers on Lalish.
Like what kind of claims?
Well, for example, you might hear claims of Assyrian pictograms hidden under plaster on Lalish walls, or that Assyrian rock carvings found above Duhok actually represent the seven angels.
Connecting themselves to ancient Assyria.
Exactly. Or others might suggest that ancient Sumerian cuneiform texts mention the word Ezid, meaning pure souls, thereby connecting Yazidis directly to the fountainhead of Sumerian civilization and religion.
Interesting. How should we understand these claims?
Well, these stories, while maybe surprising or, you know, amusing to an outsider accustomed to strict historical methods, they are vital new origin myths for the community now. They play the same function, really, as the older myth involving Seth, which was about tracing their lineage back to a chosen figure to gain legitimacy and prestige in the eyes of others in the past.
So it's about contemporary meaning and recognition.
Yes. They confer a prestigious origin using language and symbolism that might be understandable, appreciated by outsiders today. It proves the enduring, adaptable nature of Lalish's spiritual role. It's a source of identity, of pride, constantly evolving to meet contemporary needs and challenges. Lalish isn't just their past, it's being actively reimagined as part of their future narrative on the world stage.
Lalish's story is truly captivating. It's not just, as you said, a collection of ancient stones, is it? It's a living, breathing testament to the enduring spirit of a people, a remarkable, luminous history of perseverance, of adaptation.
It really is. Its history is a microcosm of the entire Yazidi experience, this complex tapestry woven from ancient faith, Susi mysticism, incredible architectural ingenuity, and then repeated, brutal desecration.
Yeah.
Yet, through it all, its significance has only deepened. Each act of destruction has been met with this determined reconstruction.
And a powerful testament.
It really is. To the resilience of spiritual belief and the enduring power of a sacred place to define and sustain a community through centuries of adversity.
It invites us, I think, to consider a really powerful question, one that resonates far beyond this valley. How does a place, even when it's physically attacked, seemingly broken, how does it grow in spiritual importance? How does it become an even more vital symbol of resilience for its community? How does a history of constant survival, of reassertion, profoundly shape the very essence, the meaning of a sacred space? How does it transform it from just a target into this enduring, luminous beacon for its people?
It speaks volumes, I think, about the profound human need for a spiritual center, a place of belonging, of continuity, especially when facing profound adversity. Lalish embodies this. It's constantly being rebuilt, not just physically, but spiritually, mythologically too. Always drawing its people back, it proves that the deepest connections, the most resilient identities, are often forged in fire, making Lalish an eternal testament to the human spirit's capacity for faith, for endurance.
Thank you for joining us on this exploration of Lalish on the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. We hope this has given you a deeper understanding of its luminous history, its incredible story of survival.